Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets snap a four-week losing streak in one of the best weeks since June. Technicals may be still providing overhead resistance, though, and a new month is here, waiting on the employment report. Our guest today is Erin Lowry, author of Broke Millennial Takes on Investing. All this and much more on episode number 626 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Coming to you from Hurricane Central. Yep, I'm Andrew Horowitz, host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast and co-host of DH Unplugged. Each and every week on Tuesdays, myself and John C. Dvorak get together. We have quite the hoot. If you haven't listened to that show, I tell you all the time, you really want to listen to that show. We have a really good time, a fun time, talking about some of the crazy things that are happening in the financial market and the news around the world. Also, I mentioned that this week I was the guest on Frank Curzio's podcast, Wall Street Unplugged, and we did some battle because I've been calling out Frank about this whole idea of tariffs where he's like, it's going to end quickly. It's not a worry. Don't worry about it. You know, it's going to pass over. We're going to win. It's going to be easy. And I've been telling him, Frank, you really need to look at some of the other details. And we talked about this in depth on his show. So if you haven't listened to that, go over to Frank Curzio's website, Curzio, I think it's CurzioResearch.com, and listen in on that, or grab it over on one of the podcast, the hundred of podcast directories that are out there these days. I think there was some really good information there. Also, he mentioned some of the stocks he liked and talked about algos in depth in that episode. And I talked about some stock picks as well, that some things that were coming to mind and a couple that I thought were kind of interesting. So definitely check that out. You could also find that, by the way, on my Twitter feed. I put that over there and I linked to that particular show. So as I mentioned, and as you know, because it's all over the news, anywhere you look, we have Hurricane Dorian that is barreling down somewhere. So it started out, of course, all the way to the east, and it started making its way over, as hurricanes do, throughout the tropics into the Gulf, and gets warm water and heats up and it throws everything into a tizzy. People panic. People get apprehensive. A lot of things happening. And the latest update that we have, it's going to skirt a little bit north, is two high-pressure systems. Meteorologist Horowitz here. Two high-pressure systems that are holding it down and then is going to scoot right through, it looks like, and head just off the coast and north. But the good news is that, yeah, there is a reprieve, it seems, for South Florida, but we may have some problems into Georgia, North Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina. So everybody that's there, be safe. It's not anything to take lightly, these storms, especially if they intensify as they have. The last look I had was like 145 to 150 mile an hour winds approaching Category 5 right now, Category 4 from last I saw it. But I want to get into the office and do this podcast and get it out a little bit earlier than usual, because just in case there was no power, goodness gracious, I wouldn't want you to have a week where we didn't have a podcast. I mean, you know, that would be a problem. So I thought I'd get this out early. And as this was all happening, and as I was watching the news, and as I was flipping from channel to channel, the local channels and the weather channel, online at windfinder.com and weatherunderground.com and clicking on weather.com, trying to really put together, all right, what am I going to do here? How much preparation am I going to make? Am I going to need to evacuate? What's going to happen here? I started thinking that these hurricanes are very much like preparation for market events. There's a lot of similarities that go on. And in particular, we start out with the whole emotional aspect of, you know, what's coming? Is it coming to me? it's coming to me. I'm nervous. I get apprehensive. I have worry and maybe even panic. And then at right now, where it looks like it's scooting north, I have a bit of elation and a little bit of emotional relief. And then maybe back to concern again as it may wobble around and change direction. And maybe we'll get hit by just a corner of it. And then, you know, start thinking about, all right, what about the next one? What am I going to do about that? It's hurricane season. And it does remind me of markets in a way, because those same emotions seem to be prevalent in what we do on a regular basis, thinking about markets. Investors get greedy. They get fearful. They get apprehensive. They worry about things that are coming, and they start making a variety of plays, and they change their structure. And we think about this like a storm. And you have this storm that shows us evidence that it's forming, just like a storm in the markets where you have evidence possibly of a corrective action happening, a recession approaching. And we may go through some of the same exact fears and emotional cycles. And that's why there's so much volatility in the markets, because there's indecision, there's concern, there's confidence that erodes. All these things that go into play, that different people have different ways of dealing with things and different outlooks. Different outlooks from the research they've done, different outlooks from the information that they've gathered, from what they've heard, from what they've seen, from their history. Someone who's never been through something may be at first very nervous, whereas someone who's been through a lot of those storms, whether they're market or weather related, may take a much more realistic approach to it. Look at this as, well, we know what's going to happen. We can make preparations. We don't have to panic about this. But this is why we see such volatility in the markets, because there's a lot of people that have different ways of looking at things and different approaches and different realizations, different desires, different risk. So with a hurricane, the most conservative people out there, they're going to worry. They're going to worry early. They get their houses in order. They board it all up well in advance, because we saw a trajectory that looked like it was going to hit somewhere in the vicinity of South Florida. We start seeing people last week boarding up their houses, stockpiling on essentials, and maybe even thinking about evacuating. They want to get ahead of the masses. They don't want to get involved in any last minute. And what if water runs out? What if I can't get gas? What if the power goes out for a period of time? I got to make sure to get all my flashlights and my batteries and everything in order. Get the place boarded up. Worst comes to worst, I'll just take it all down. I'll just reverse this. But you know what? I don't want to be a part of this. I don't want to be near any of this. I don't want to deal with this. So what happens is those early movers, if you will, are going to panic. The problem is it's really hard to predict where a hurricane is going, as we've seen with Dorian. We don't know if it's going to hit directly. It's going to move offshore. It's going to dissipate. Some landmass is going to break it up a little bit, and there's going to be less of a wind stream that happens. You know, maybe some rain, maybe just a tropical storm. But we rely on those with knowledge. We watch the TVs. We look for those that have models, and they predict what's going to happen. And the same thing is true with markets. Now, with markets, we have meteorologists. Meteorologists are like the analysts that appear on TV, right? Think about that. So you have meteorologists that are constantly giving us predictions, and they're using charts, and they're using all sorts of historical reference to give us what could happen, where it could go, utilizing all these different things. Whereas we have analysts who do the same thing. They look at, well, interest rates are doing this, and gold is doing that, and the moving average is doing this, and we have this probability that's going to happen with markets. I mean, same thing. A different wrapper as we have with a hurricane. The same exact situation. So we have all these predictions going on, and now all of a sudden the consumption of that information comes into my ears, my eyes, your eyes, your knowledge base, your history, your risk tolerance and time horizon, and we start making decisions. And as we know, because we know this, predicting a storm, like trying to predict a market outcome, is very difficult. Meteorologists and analysts pretty much have the same record. They're often wrong, and there are many factors and rightfully so, that meteorologists are wrong, because a lot of things change over time and weather is unpredictable, and what happens in the atmosphere and all the things that come together can give you a best guess at what's happening and where things are going to go. But every few hours when we get an update, things change. And as things change, they change their analysis, they change their predictions, and their models change. Same thing with analysts, and particularly with, more so, with economists. And when we watched, I think the parallels between a hurricane approaching and possibly some market event approaching, I think there is just a lot to be said about the similarity and what happens with people and the emotions. So as we have with people in hurricanes that are early to prepare, and we have people in the markets that do the same, right? They get way ahead of the potential market storm. They clean out their holdings. They board up their portfolio. They go to cash and they hunker down because they see something happening in the future. They're not sure what it is, but you know what? They don't want to deal with it. That's one type of person. They're way in advance. There's other types. There are those in, whether it's hurricanes or maybe even market corrective actions or in advance of something that's coming down, they want to maybe do some preparation, but wait. They're going to wait to see if there's more information. They're going to wait to see if, you know, this really plays out. We're going to wait a little time. Yes, it's a little bit riskier to wait a little bit, but let's see a solid signal before we make any major decisions, before we make any major adjustments or even evacuate. They look for more evidence. They have a bit of a cooler head, less panic. They want to make a good and timely decision, but they don't have to be the first to do so. And the hurricane was a great example of this. And really tie this back, everything I'm saying that I'm talking about here, tie it back to investing. Because the hurricane was heading right to the southeast coast of Florida a couple days ago. There was plenty of time to make decisions, but even after the storm, path was kind of unclear. Gas stations had long lines. They ran out of gas all over the place here. Stores were running out of bottled water. I saw people boarding up their houses last week. People talking about evacuating. Some people decided, you know what, to hell with it. I'm getting on a plane, I'm going to New Hampshire. And as the storm path started to emerge, it looked like there was a chance initially that maybe South Florida would be spared. Then all of a sudden there was a little bit of a change, and we saw that as we got closer, there was more lines, more fear, running out of water, gas was still out, emergency notes coming out from all the various, whether it's the fire department, the police department, the city, all sorts of places started sending out all these, hey, get prepared. Now, I did some basic prep. I fueled my car. I got some water. I had water. I made sure we had flashlights and there was batteries. And I developed a plan for evacuation if I needed to do so. And I thought that, well, if the storm made a direct hit, I'd still have plenty of time. It's a slow-moving storm, 12 miles an hour. I know where we are. I know where I can go. There's plenty of room with a lot of friends I have out west, which would be easy to get to, 25 miles inland. And they have a really good house that has, I don't think, ever lost power throughout all the hurricanes we've had down here in history. Anything's possible, of course, but it's a safe house. I can go there anytime I want. I knew my plan. And at the same time, I felt that, you know what, there was no reason to get crazy. Because really, I had until Saturday to make a good decision. If I wanted to take all the stuff out of the tiki, take all the chairs and the furniture inside, move all the potted plants inside, tie down the boat, strap up the tiki, make sure everything was bolted down. I had plenty of time. Not a reckless amount of time, not getting too close to the edge where, man, I'm doing this all in 40 mile an hour winds. I mean, Saturday, under all circumstances, looked like it was going to be getting a little bit bad, but still Sunday afternoon to Sunday night into Monday. So all I had to do was understand that I needed a plan, execute on it with plenty of time, and then if things changed, I can adjust. So I was being flexible. And lo and behold, I don't have to do half the things that I was thinking I was going to do. I didn't have to worry about, you know, where am I going to park the car if I fill up the garage with all sorts of, you know, goods? Where am I going to put all the out, you know, exterior furniture if I, you know, whatever? Do I have to, you know, move the barbecue? Do I have to strap the tiki down? Do I have to take down all the fans outside? All the lighting? Like I would if, in fact, it was coming right at us. Same is true as we talk about the markets. Remember that long fuse we discussed recently and the idea that this debt bomb is coming? Now, on one hand, there are a lot of people that are like, all right, the hell this, I'm out of this, I'm out of bonds, I'm out of foreign. I think there's a correction coming. Well, I'm going to be, you know, if that's what they're thinking, that I'm going to just blow all my stocks out of base, essentially evacuate their portfolio. And while I do believe there's going to be a reckoning coming in the future, it may take a little bit of a different path as time goes on, just as we see the forecast with a hurricane. And why is that? Simple. Because we may see interventions, we may see changes, we may see some governmental actions. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, so it's not a directional course straight to. It's a bit of a curvy process. Things change. So as this is going on, we may see intensification, a change in direction, or kind of a fizzling to a point. I still think it's going to happen, but nonetheless, what do we do about it as investors? What do we do about this whole thing? Yeah, you need to do basic prep. There's no question. You need to have a plan. You need to evaluate your portfolio positioning. You need to look at an evacuation plan just in case. But there's no need right now to board up your portfolio until we have further evidence of where essentially the center of the storm is going to hit. Is it going to be high yield bonds? Is it going to be the continuation of the downtrend of small caps domestically? Is it going to be something that happens external to foreign bonds? Is it going to be commodities? Where is it? Or is it going to be just one giant mess? We don't know that right now. We're getting evidence in, and you can react on the incremental points that we see as time goes on. But at the same time, you know, you don't want to necessarily think about this in a way that is destructive. It doesn't mean do nothing. Because here, we're making incremental changes to portfolio allocations and ready to move if there are further signs of problems. That's baseline. But then you have to ask yourself, what do you do? You have to look at your risk tolerance, of course. You have to look at your time horizon. And we need to watch, and you need to watch, at the waves of concerns that come in the form of selling, in the form of leading sectors that are moving or not moving, and then adjust accordingly. So again, we look at this storm track for Dorian and how it changed over time and over the last few days. Think about it as a compressed view of what happens with markets. And really, at the end of the day, the whole idea of readiness and preparation and being smart, not panicking until the event is over, is really your best plan of action. Then generally, a cleanup plan, of course, needs to be implemented after that. And that also takes preparation ahead of the storm, because you don't want to have your plan of how to get back in the markets, if in fact you did sell at a portion, waiting until after the fact. You want to do that and have that set up before the storm hits. So I want you to think of this concept of an approaching storm when you consider the whole idea of what you're doing with your portfolio, as the evidence seems to mount on a regular basis that there's trouble brewing, whether it's going to be a recession, whether it's going to be a bond explosion, a fixed income explosion, whether it's going to be an overall market trend that changes, or none of the above, something different or nothing. Get your plan in order, but have a plan. Stick to the plan and base your plan on facts and evidence. I think that's probably the biggest key here. You want to make sure to base your plan on the evidence and the facts that are out there. We're not making things up. Yes, there are predictions. There are people saying this. There are news media saying that. There are analysts that are predicting, you know, upside opportunity moving forward, and there's downside. We got the Fed that's talking on a regular basis. We got the president tweeting and talking. You know, we have a lot of inputs to look at. But at the end of the day, don't be one of those stubborn people that are going to ride out the storm no matter where the epicenter of it is. There are a lot of people that live on the beach like, I'm not leaving my house. I don't care. I'm not doing it. I've been through hurricanes before. It doesn't matter if this eye wall hits right on top of my house. I'm staying. And then they end up finding out that that was a bad decision. So think about this as just an idea when we compare a storm that may or may not come to your portfolio, where a correction or a recession or some change in the dynamic may or may not come, to be prepared. That's really the essence of what I really want to get through here, is the whole idea of being prepared. And if you're not prepared, or if you don't know how to be prepared, find someone to help you. You don't have to do this alone. I mean, I'll tell you right now, when it comes to taking down all the things in the tiki and strapping the boat, I got a couple of guys coming over and help me out. People that are good at this. It's not my strongest suit. So you know what? I'm going to let them help out. If they need help on something that I'm better at, I'll help them with that. So whether it's a friend, whether it's a professional, probably that's the better route. But if it's a professional, find somebody that can give you a plan and an escape route, an evacuation route, just in the event that things don't go exactly as well as they may, and make sure it's aligned with your particular outlook and your risk tolerance and profile, okay? So I think that's a good lesson for today, and I think very timely with this hurricane moving and grooving and changing direction and doing its thing. So take that for what it's worth. Just run with it. I'll mention that, because I got, again, a lot of emails about this. A lot of people are starting to look over at investology.com, ENVESTOLOGY.com. This is our robo-esque style of advisor-crafted and technology-enhanced investing. So with that in mind, let's get to our guest and talk about millennials. And our guest today is Erin Lowry. She's the author of Broke Millennial, Stop Scraping By and Get Your Financial Life Together, and the book Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, A Beginner's Guide to Leveling Up Your Money. So, Erin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How are things up there in New York?
So far, so good. The terrible heat of the summer is calming down a little bit. Yeah.
Where are you in New York?
I'm in Queens.
Queens. I actually was born in Jamaica.
Oh, yeah.
Jamaica, Queens, for those of you that are thinking it was the island. My grandparents lived and I worked in Bayside. My parents went to Bayside High. And I know the area pretty well. So
that is quite far from where I am. Queens is huge.
Yeah. And getting bigger. You know, it's interesting, just a quick side note, when I recently went up, and you know, way back in the day, we used to go through from Long Island. We would drive through Long Island City and go into Manhattan. And back then, when you went through Long Island City, you would lock your doors and you would kind of, you know, pray that you made it through. And these days, Long Island City, wow.
Yeah, it's stunning now.
Unbelievable.
So, I'm in Astoria, which is just north of Long Island City. I've been here for almost 9 years now. And that's the whole time I've been in New York. I've been in Astoria, Queens, different parts, but here the whole time.
By LaGuardia Airport, the home of the best Greek food in the area.
It's true. Yep. I was told when I first moved here that, I don't know if we still hold the title, but we had the largest Greek population outside of Greece itself.
I would think so. Astoria was always the place you went for Greek food.
Still is. Yeah. I will say, I will not eat Greek anywhere else in New York.
I don't blame you. So let's talk a little bit about millennials, our favorite subject to poke fun at every once in a while. Sorry about that. But,
I'm here for it. Yeah. I'm very used to it.
So millennials. It's kind of one day far off in the future. We'll really get down to the bottom line on why there's been such a significant change in the way things are and the way they're seen, and whether it was the big crash and the whole thing about 2008, 2009, or the way parents were and they treated them. And I think the everybody gets a trophy thing had a lot to do with some things in terms of outlook and perspective. But what is it that millennials are looking at and doing differently in terms of investing that is very noticeable and clearly different than we've seen from other generations?
Well, for starters, there is a lot of conversation that we don't invest, which is not true. There are plenty of millennials that are investing, even if it's just into a retirement account, which everyone forgets is actually investing, because I think a big problem is the language we use. We say save for retirement. I think that that's a misnomer. But really, the other thing that I think is quite unique about both the millennial generation, and I will lump in younger Gen Xers, is the idea of ethical and sustainable investing and actually looking under the hood at where you're putting your money and starting to vocalize like, hey, I do not want to invest in that. So if this is a fund that has a company that produces a product or drills or does something that I find unethical, I don't want to put my money there. There has been more conversation around sustainable or impact investing or social investing, bunch of different names for very similar things. And that's certainly one. And another thing is technology has completely changed the game. And that's mostly just a byproduct of the times that we have access in a very different way than any generation before us. It doesn't make us better or worse investors. It just opens up a unique possibility that we have now, whether it's micro investing, robo advisors, you don't have to have a ton of cash in order to even get started. So it really provides a lot more opportunity.
You know, one of the things that I find really interesting when you talk about this whole idea of saving versus investing and the whole socially acceptable and what is maybe sustainable or maybe the sin stocks that we don't want to be involved in. Years ago, there was a whole movement into social awareness investing or, you know, hey, let's invest in only companies that have a equal amount of women and men on the boards, or pick whatever particular topic that you want, right? You know, whatever that feel good thing is. But I have a question for you. So let's take a company, doesn't really matter, but let's say a tobacco company, okay? And maybe let's say that's on the list of no-nos. You know, smoking is bad. And tell me why you won't invest in that company if you know that company is a good company in the future in terms of their prospects, assuming that's the case. What is it about them? It's just reprehensible from a social aspect?
It depends on the person. So tobacco for some could be a no-no, and for others, they don't care about tobacco as a product. What you have to think about is there's now quite a distinction between the greed is good, capitalism, money wins all mentality, and the I care how I'm earning my money type rhetoric. So there are people who are willing to sacrifice gains and money in the long term in order to feel ethical about how they are doing that. And I'm not saying it's everyone, but that certainly has become a shift. Now, I think for millennials, and I'm certain it's going to be true for Gen Z, one of the big ones recently has been gun manufacturing and defense contracts and people wanting to divest their money from companies that engage in those products. So that's been a huge call. And there have been people who have really petitioned brokerages to offer index funds that screens out those particular companies and or products.
So if you don't invest in that company, let's use the gun manufacturers as a good example. If you don't invest in that company, buy their publicly traded stock that's on the secondary market, what is it that you think that's happening that if everybody does this, I guess, what's the thought? That the stock won't do well and therefore they'll change their ways? Because I think the misnomer in all this is that if you invest in a gun manufacturer, you're giving the company money and therefore supporting them. When in fact, you're just supporting the valuation of the stock for the public markets, which is quite a bit different than giving the money for them to utilize and profit from, isn't it?
But the thing that you're, I think, missing in is, frankly, this is a strange way to put it, it's the icky factor for people.
Well, that's a different story.
How it feels. That's different. And I really do believe that a lot of people, because, again, this is wealth of information that we have now, you can easily now access, even though some of it is, you know, deep in a prospectus, but it's much easier now to access information about in what you are investing. So for people where it could be religious reasons, it could just be personal ethical reasons, they don't want to invest in certain companies, they therefore want the option to screen it out. But if you're lump sum putting all of your money in ETFs or index funds, that can be much harder because, you know, if you're going to just do an S&P 500, but you don't want to invest in anyone who is perhaps having ethics in terms of impact on the environment, casinos, alcohol, tobacco. I mean, these are all very common examples of what people try to screen out. Again, I think a lot of times it just simply comes to the ick factor. People feel that putting money in whatever way that they think is supporting a certain product or company, they just don't want any part of it.
So let's say we have the S&P 500 index minus ick. Okay? Mm-hmm. And that, for whatever reason, includes things like, as you mentioned, gun manufacturers, defense companies, possibly certain maybe pharmaceutical firms that are charging too much, possibly some hospitals or HMOs, maybe even beef. Excuse me. Maybe even companies that are making products that have preservatives, GMO modified, and okay. So we have S&P 500 minus ick. Now S&P 500 minus ick does 6% per year. S&P does 9% per year. Do you believe that over time there's going to be a happiness factor? The non-ick, I'm good, I'm glad of what I'm doing. People will be satisfied with that if that is the case. That's the scenario I'm building.
Yeah, I believe you'd be surprised, because for a lot of people, it does also come down to ethics and how they feel about the ways in which they're earning their cash. Again, this is not true for everyone.
Yeah.
This is a subset of the population. But if they feel that they're willing to sacrifice a 3% return in order to feel good about how they're getting their money, and you know they're handily beating inflation and they're still on track to meet all their financial goals, then yeah, I think that they're going to be fine with it. And frankly, I'm going to be honest with you, I don't know how many people at the end of the day are really comparing their returns to the returns of the S&P plus ick, if you will.
Yeah, inclusive of ick. So, okay. So now, in terms of this whole idea that you're bringing up here, which is the feel good, I feel satisfied, I feel like I'm doing the right thing. When it comes to my work, I'm willing to take a little bit less to feel good about what I'm doing, right? So listen, let's go way back. Way back, I remember times when I had my first jobs that you never felt good about anything, right? Where you'd be yelled at, scolded, thrown out, they'd throw food on you. Who knows what would happen, right? It was just not, you're calling you names, jeering you, doing all that. That kind of stuff doesn't fly anymore. I mean, you can't get in somebody's face. I used to have nose to nose with a manager. You can't do that anymore. So,
no, you can't.
But at the same time, it seems to me that the millennials and people today, not just millennials, people today don't want to sacrifice pay either. You know, they want the pay they're entitled to, even though they may be new in the job. Whereas when I first started my job, I'm like, okay, if you're going to pay me, that's nice. If not, okay, I'm learning, I'm doing, I'm going to do it. But that's changed also. It seems like there's a different level of greed today with people, don't you think?
Well, I don't feel that two need to be mutually exclusive, to not have your boss get in your face and to make decent money. But I will also say there's plenty of people who don't make a terribly livable wage right off the bat. And part of that could have been when you graduated. I made $23,000 my first year living in New York City, and I was working three different jobs. So I certainly was hustling to try to make ends meet.
Right.
And then my job after that, which was my first kind of real professional steady job, I was only making $37,500, which again, New York City. So you would think that it was adjusted for cost of living, but not so much. And I was very fortunate that I had selected a university where I graduated debt-free. So I was able to make those decisions and take those lower paying jobs, frankly, because I didn't have the burden of student loans. But that's an anomaly for a lot of people. And I also, the way I kind of think about it, times have changed. We've evolved in how we interact with people. I understand very much why some of the overcorrection, if you will, to like trigger words, safe space, microaggressions get obnoxious. I understand that.
Thank you. Because it does get a little bit much after a while.
But there's a healthy medium.
Yep,
I don't think your boss ever needs to be screaming in your face.
Yep.
I don't believe that that's ever appropriate. Sans like certain very specific jobs where it could be a life or death scenario and you need to be talking to someone in that manner. But in an office environment, that does not need to be.
I agree. And by the way, to put this in perspective, my first job in New York, which was in Bayside, by the way, I made $30,000 my first year in 1980. We'll call it five. Well, my first major job, not the waiters and the stuff. I mean, maybe like 30, I made 30,000. So your first job was well past 1987 or 1985.
2011.
And you were still making the same amount of money.
Right, which is part of the frustration, certainly. And, you know, sensibilities of generations change from time to time. I think it's always interesting to go back and look. It's a time-honored tradition for the generation before to use a negative term, crap on the one that's coming after them.
Oh, yeah, so much fun.
I'm sure we're going to do it to Gen Z right. just as hard as it was done to us.
Of course, of course.
And most generations at some point will call the next one soft for whatever reason that it is. I mean, you're looking at the greatest generation, and then after that, you saw rise of the hippies. They certainly had feelings about that as a generation, and I feel it's the same for millennials. I understand why the boomers will look at millennials the way that they do, and poor Gen Xers are essentially the forgotten generation. No one ever talks about them. So it's just that times change, and sometimes there is maybe an over-calibration in the other direction that I think eventually gets smoothed out.
So let's talk about this when it comes to investing. The idea of these up-and-coming or these generations that are now involved in investing. So there's a couple of, you know, not that have been seasoned in the area, but just kind of, you know, newer in it. And millennials and Gen X and all that, and Gen Y and Z. What comes after Z?
So millennials are Gen Y, and then what's next is Gen Z.
And then we're out of letters.
I guess we'll go back to A. I have no idea. They have not announced it yet.
Okay, just checking. And who is it that announces that?
Pew Research. There's a bunch of them that come up with it when they start researching the generation. There has been rumors about Generation I, like internet, because of the digital natives, but that was some conversation about Gen Z. I don't know. We'll see what happens. Just give them another decade.
So what are they doing in terms of investing? I mean, there's a lot of different options these days. There's things like Robinhood, which personally is a nice tool to kind of play around with. I don't like it in terms of the efficiency, cost factors, and all that. But it makes it easy. It makes it handheld. There's robo-investing, which is automated. There's the old traditional stuff. I mean, what's going on and the trends that you're seeing in that area?
Well, I'm glad, first of all, that you already brought up fees, because that to me is the big, big thing to keep pushing on, is people not always understanding the fee factor. And I always try to bring that up when I talk about micro investing, because it sounds so minimal for a lot of them. Not Robinhood, it's a slightly different platform. But for others, they'll say, oh, $1 a month or $2 a month or $3 a month, which again, I can't do a load of laundry for that amount of money. So it sounds like a steal. But if you're only investing, quote unquote, your spare change or a handful of dollars a month, and you feel like, oh, I'm getting started, I'm investing, but you're paying $2, $3 a month in fees, you're not seeing any returns. In fact, you're probably going into the red. So that's a big one for me with the micro investing, is that sometimes it's almost too easy and people don't take it seriously enough. Now, not true, again, of everyone. And I believe that it's good that most of these apps have really built in a very strong education component. So there is a level of trying to teach people how the market works, what it means to be investing, some of the language that exists, even as simple as when you're starting to see all the recession conversation or market correction conversation in the news. A lot of the apps and robo-advisors will send auto blasts out to everyone. It's like, don't panic. This is a natural part of economic cycles. We plan for this with how we develop your investment portfolio. So it's nice that there's some level of handholding with not the price point of working with a traditional advisor. And part of it for a lot of folks is still feeling this disconnect of thinking that advisors are just for the ultra wealthy and that that's not something I'm ready for or can afford. Again, times are changing, not so true anymore. There are plenty of advisors that work for people with far less than $1 million net worth. There are certainly advisors that will create a one-off financial plan, fee-only based planners. Really, it should be more of a long-term relationship, but these options do exist now. It's also just the education process of making sure people know what all their different options are.
You know, it's interesting because over the last couple of years, we've developed a robo-esque type of a platform for individuals. And the reason was we were asked to do so. And, you know, we had a $500,000 minimum for some of our portfolios, but we were asked to do something where we can give them a good chunk of the investment advice at a much lower entry point. And we did so with the idea that, oh, you know what? People, you know, want to invest online. They don't really want to work with an advisor. That was part of it. And then we're like, okay, well, you know, some people are nervous about this and they think that, you know, it's overwhelming to work with somebody. They're much more comfortable in a neutral relationship without the emotions and just using their phone or their computer and something. So, I mean, that all came into the play. But at the same time, we were able to actually, as you are pointing out here, we were able to give them a high level of portfolio management at a much lower entry cost in terms of investment. So it kind of worked out really nicely for us. At first, we were very skeptical about it. Oh, no, we're not going to do that. How are we going to do that? But it's worked out really well. And, you know, so there is that bit of a happy medium. But the other thing you talk about fees, this is a problem for me in terms of some of the overcorrection, as you've mentioned, in terms of the fees, you know, this fees, the fees, the fees, the cost. It's like, wait a minute. Let's get something straight. First of all, nothing's free. Mm-hmm. Second of all, some of the things that people are looking at is they're looking at an ETF. What's the cost? Well, it's 10 basis points or 25 basis points. Well, I can get that one for 7 basis points. It's the same. Okay. If it's the same, I'm good with that, right? I mean, how could I argue that? However, there have been times that we've seen that there is a significant differential in the investment process when it comes to things like bonds, for example, and people are saying, well, I want to be in the ETF because it's cheaper. Not looking at the ramifications of what's the difference between this investment and that may be an equally, it may look like the same thing, but it's really not. And we have found that a lot of people have been, whether it's brainwashed or they've been educated to a point that they just want to look at the fees rather than the whole thing. Because I'll ask you this question. If you had an investment that yielded you 10% and it was 10 basis points, or you had an investment that was yielding you 20%, but it cost you 20% a year to do so, so you netted 20% on your returns, right? Somehow, magically, I don't know, there's a very high fee for this thing. A lot of people would say, no, I want the cheaper investment. Well, wait a minute, this one's doing 20% a year. Again, I'm making this up here. But they're just like, no, I want the lower fee. I'm like, but don't you want the higher returns? Yeah, but this one costs less. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? So there's something going on with that whole dynamic.
Yep, and it's hard to identify exactly. Obviously, there are multiple factors with any scenario like this. Part of it, again, access to knowledge and information. People can compare in a different way than they could before. I feel that in many areas of our lives, not just investing, we are reared in this idea of trying to find a deal, trying to find the cheapest option. That's such a common thing that you will hear, which could play into it. You also have a lot of, again, with the rise of personal finance blogging and influencers and all of that, there are many people who will dogmatically stick to, you need to be investing in these 1, 2, 3 index funds with this particular brokerage. That's it. Well, that particular type of conversation actually drives me nuts a little bit, mostly because they don't know you. They don't know your risk tolerance. They don't know your goals. They don't know your time horizon. It's hard to give somebody investing advice without the whole picture, mm-hmm. but a lot of people do it. And I do wonder, I have really no hypothesis on this, but I do wonder, again, millennials are starting to age on the older end of the spectrum, getting closer to 40. I think people tend to forget that. And as we grow older, we start families, we're more stable financially in our experiences, we might then pivot back into the more traditional models of wanting someone there to hold hands when building your financial portfolio. But I think part of it too, consider the wealth transfer, it's eventually coming. And I don't know that necessarily the advisors to our parents are doing a great job of courting the younger demographic. Like, you should want to keep that person's business. Mm-hmm. So you should be making contact early on.
Yeah. But that, like you said, it's not always easy because there is a little bit of a roadblock, and we call that technology, in between that.
I think it's as simple as dropping them an email, to be totally honest.
No, okay.
There are certain aspects where it's just building a relationship early, as opposed to like, well, mom and dad died and you're inheriting all this money. Want to stay with me? Mm-hmm. Like, there's just something about starting to curate that relationship a little bit earlier. Yep. Especially, you know, most parents are bragging about their kids. So just checking in and, hey, you know, I work with your parents. They told me you were up to XYZ. Just wanted to say, if you ever have any questions, feel free to reach out.
I got
something that simple.
Good idea. So now let's talk about the focus, the financial focus that you think that millennials should have? You talked about at the beginning of this discussion that a lot of people in this generation have been saddled with an extreme amount of student debt, that we're even hearing crazy stories about the potential for that being relieved by the government, which I'm not sure what kind of social harm that's going to do if it happens, or economic problems that that will do. But nonetheless, what are some of the things that millennials should be focusing on with regard to their current financial situation?
My big thing right now is that there's no white knight, so don't plan as if there's going to be one. I've started getting emails and direct messages on Instagram about, it might get forgiven, so should I stop paying? I'm like, absolutely not. And frankly, for those who are in a position to pay it off aggressively, I mean, my husband and I are paying off student loans very aggressively, and we're not going to let up on that gas just because there's this small potential that maybe in a few years it could get forgiven. He's a teacher. He qualifies for public service loan forgiveness. And even that, I'm like, I don't want to deal with it. Let's just pay this off. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much paperwork. There's a chance of getting rejected. There's just so many factors that come along with it. And we are financially in a very fortunate situation that we can aggressively pay off the student loans. So we're just going to do it.
So you got student loans. What about housing? Housing has been an issue that there's been, as you talked about earlier, well, a lot of people say that millennials don't invest, but that's not really true. A lot of people say that millennials don't buy houses, but that's not true either.
Again, aging into it. I think that it's been, we haven't done it on the same timeline as previous generations, which is really more of what the storyline should be, other than it's not that we don't do it, it's that we didn't do it at the same time. From marriage to having kids to buying homes. And listen, a lot of this is very regional. It does depend on where you live. I was just recently in Birmingham, Alabama, and a lot of the women I spoke to who were in their early 20s were married with children who had homes. I live in New York City. None of my girlfriends, and we're all in our 30s, have kids. Mm-hmm. And many of us are just starting to get married. Some of that is just a very regional bias that happens. Now, with the home ownership, I feel a lot of people eventually want to buy. Again, depends on your location. I live in New York City. Doesn't feel like a terribly realistic possibility for me at the moment. But most of my friends who live outside of a huge city with crushing housing costs, San Francisco, New York, they own. So I think, again, it would just took a little bit longer than for previous generations.
Yeah, and because, like you said, the housing budget that other generations may have had is now your student loan budget.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
and that's part of it. I mean, it's a combination of certain people also thinking about student loans, certain people because of the recession delayed entering the workforce and went right to get a master's, some even to go as far as a PhD or a second master's, kind of biding time. The whole over-educated, underemployed situation certainly happened. There are a lot of people, like you said, with very hefty monthly student loan bills, even at a minimum. We could be talking $500-$600 a month, and yeah, that's a mortgage.
So let's get even more simple, even more basic investing, not even 101, investing one. Talk about, because I know you talked about this in your book, and again, it's the Broke Millennial, Stop Scraping Broke By.
No, that's book one. Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, A Beginner's Guide to Leveling Up Your Money is book two with investing.
Oh, that's the one in here that I saw. You're right. Obviously you're right. You wrote it. But anyway, talk about compounding interest and make people understand the importance of, obviously starting early.
Oh, that's one of my favorite slides to do when I give presentations, because I compare two different people, one of whom started investing into her retirement account at 25. And then her husband, who waits until he's 35, tries to double down. I call them Leslie and Ben. Leslie puts $400 a month away. Ben, 10 years later, puts $800 a month away. They get, on average, I think I say 7% return over the course of between 30 and 40 years. And Leslie still crushes Ben. And my point with that really is this idea that if you start early with a smaller amount and stay consistent, you're still going to win, as opposed to trying to double down later. And I hear a lot of people that will talk about, when I get into my mid-30s and I make more money and my debt's paid off, that's when I'll worry about investing for retirement. problem is, and this is a topic that got brought up multiple times by people I interviewed in the book, is life tends to get more complicated, not less. So even if you're earning more, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have more discretionary money to put towards things like investing, especially if you decide to perhaps get married, buy a house, have a family. You never know, but possible health issues could come up. So it's just start early, be consistent. But my favorite way to really position compound interest, because I say, you know, it's earning interest on your interest, which sounds like this very nice idea up top. But I feel the easiest way to really contextualize it for people, especially millennials, is to ask, have you ever tried paying off a student loan or credit card debt or even an auto loan? And you know that feeling of putting so much money towards the loan every single month, and it seems to not be getting any smaller. Well, that's compound interest, but it's working against you. And with investing, you can harness the powers for good and make it work for you.
Yeah, good stuff. I like to illustrate the penny a day doubled.
Oh, yeah.
Every day for that one. And, the question is, you have a penny a day. If I give you a job for 30 days and I tell you, hey, I'm going to give you $1,000 a day, or I give you the choice of a penny a day doubled every single day. So it goes from 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 64, 32, whatever it goes to, you know, the whole rap. What would you take? And most people are like, well, I know it's a joke and it was probably the penny, but it seems logical that I should take the $1,000 a day. Mm-hmm. But the penny, I don't even remember what the number is, but it's some million-dollar number, some crazy number.
Yeah.
At the end of the 30 days, because that compounding interest and the velocity of the compounding of interest over time, as there's more money to compound against, really adds up significantly. So, yeah, and I could tell you stories about people that I know that start out a job. I'm like, I can't do the 401k. You know, I need all the money right now. I said, listen, just start out putting $20 a paycheck. Oh, the $20, it's a movie a week plus popcorn and this and that. Put the $20 per paycheck away and let's see what happens. You're not even going to miss it. I'm telling you, it's a job. You get the first paycheck. You don't even know how much exactly came out in taxes. And then a couple of years later, they're like, oh my God, look at all the money I got.
Mm-hmm. I love that too. I mean, if you can take the employer match, take the employer match. But I also talk about same thing with the incremental increases. So just do 1% of your paycheck. It feels like nothing. And then every 3 months, bump it up by 0.5%.
Yeah.
And it's when you do it so slowly like that, you barely notice the difference in your paycheck. And eventually you reach your goal in a very painless way.
Yep. It's like the boiling frog in a pot.
You know, I have said that line so many times and people just give me horrified looks. I'm like, is this not a very common, like, cliche idiom that we use?
Right. It is kind of horrible. I've had to
remove it because people were very startled.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you one on diversification that you could use. You know, the whole benefits of diversification.
Yes.
So I explained to people.
Eggs in a basket, but yeah.
So I explained to people it's like a flower garden.
Oh.
Actually, I wrote this in my first book, The Disciplined Investor: Essential Strategies for Success. And I say it's like a flower garden. If you have, depending on where you live, if you have a flower garden, and in your flower garden are just impatience. You know what impatience? Up there, you plant them in the summer. Down here, we plant them in the winter. You have impatience, but you know what? They last a few months. They look beautiful. They're blooming. They're red. They're purple. They're pink, white. They're beautiful. But then they die out, and all you have left is dirt. That's like not diversification correctly. In diversification, what you want to do in a flower garden is you plant some impatience, fine, but you also plant some evergreens. It's like your fixed income. You want to plant some heliconia. You want to plant some roses, things that are going to be basically blossoming at any given time during the year, so that one thing is barren because it's past its time. You have something else cropping up and you have a continually beautiful garden over time.
Now, here's my question from that example. Do you have a green thumb?
No.
Because it really sounds like you are quite the botanist.
No.
You were pulling out flower names that I did not know.
Yeah. I can pull out a few others, but that's not, I'm not good at this. Matter of fact, we have one plant in the office and I have to talk to it and nurse it and basically, you know, sit with it every day or it's going to drop dead.
Well, I managed to kill a succulent. It's very impressive that my dog is very well taken care of.
Well, in the future, let me give you a hint on how to keep succulents looking really good. I could tell you this. Wayfair.com has fake ones.
Oh, perfect.
And they come in a box. They're usually broken. You have to tell them to send you another one, but you'll get one of or two of the little stands that look good over time, and they'll just look fine. So, Aaron Lowry, author, Broke Millennial, Taking on Investing, A Beginner Guide to Leavening Up Your Money. I appreciate your help, your insights, and all that you're doing to educate this and next generation, generation I, E, F, and G coming up.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was fun to chat.
All right, thanks. And that is the end of this show. Thank you so much for joining me. Remember, this is all about preparing and making sure that you have the evidence that is available that makes the most sense, and having a plan, acting on that plan, utilizing that as a framework for what you are going to do for the future, dependent on whatever the storm brings. So until next week, we have some great guests coming up as well. I want to thank you for joining me. Make sure to retweet this. Make sure to tell people about it. Give them the link over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And keep on listening. Have a great day and a great week. Bye-bye. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.